Okay, welcome everybody. This is the sixth office hours session for the Mises Academy class. I think the rating is 400. Mises on Money and Banking. And we are really getting into the good stuff now. We've slogged through all the monetary theory, which was crucial, of course. But now going into week seven, we're going to do banking and fiduciary media. And then finally in week eight will be interest and credit monetary expansion and basically what we nowadays refer to as the Austrian theory of the business cycle. But seeing it through a, how can I put it, I guess, and I'm just sort of anticipating, I think if you guys have never read this before, let me put it to you this way. When I was in, what was I in? I don't know, maybe I was a sophomore or junior in college, undergrad, and I read The Theory of Money and Credit the first time. I read chapter 19 in the version I had, like the Liberty Fund version. And that's where, you know, Mises does the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle is what he called it. And I read it and I kept going, waiting, you know, going through the book, waiting to see when does he explain the business cycle. And I already, I read it and didn't even notice it. I mean, that's how subtle it is. And from one point of view, it's partly because I was, you know, punk and grad and undergrad. I didn't know what I was doing. But my point is just it's the way, you know, somebody from Fox Business grabs me and says, you got 60 seconds to explain the business cycle from the Austrian perspective. The way I would talk about it, you know, is not probably the ratio between consumption goods and investment goods. There's, you know, probably just, oh, the Fed lowers the interest rates. Businessmen start long-term projects. There's not enough capital goods to finance them, and then the bust occurs, you know, something like that. And you'll see that's not the angle that Mises takes in it. So anyway, I think it'll give you a different appreciation for it. And the other main thing, I'm just warming you guys up in case you've never really waded into this stuff, hit deep before, is you'll see, and partly why I was encouraging people to take this class is it is not a theory about how the central bank screws up interest rates and then that misleads entrepreneurs, right? That's not what Mises' theory is. This is going to be a theory about how the commercial banks inflate the quantity of money, namely through issuing fiduciary media, and how that sets in motion the unsustainable boom. Right, so it is Mises' original theory was not created in reference to central banks and then later because, oh, wait a minute, there were business cycles before the central banks existed, so how do we deal with that? Well, let's change. No, it was never about central banks. Central banking exacerbates the things that Mises think cause a business cycle, and we'll talk about that. So, you know, central banks are still a really bad thing if you don't like business cycles and you believe in Mises' explanation, but you'll see his basic theory is not about central banking per se, it's about fiduciary media. Okay, and there goes my alarm, so let me just check my email to see if anybody's stranded. Okay, I don't see any complaints, so I guess everybody's here is going to be here. Okay, so now that I've given that, why don't we turn it over to the people who are logged in live here and go ahead and ask any questions you have. Lewis asks, what's the next big course you're planning to teach at the Academy? Danny Sanchez and I are going back and forth about that right now. What we may do, and this isn't set in stone, it's, as you may know, I just had the teacher's manual to Lessons for the Young Economist come out. So forgive me for a second to give it a little plug. So Lessons for the Young Economist is my textbook aimed at basically junior high students, but it's also, of course, applicable to anybody who's never read up on free market economics. And we were designing it with the idea that if people are homeschooling their kids and they want to teach them economics, that this is going to be the starter book. Like, even before Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, this Lessons for the Young Economist, we think, is going to equip them to go down the road to free market economics and ultimately Austrian economics. But then all along, part of that project was I would also write a manual for the teacher, particularly with the homeschooling parent in mind, knowing that economics is kind of intimidating and a lot of the stuff if you're trying to teach somebody something, it's hard because you're worried that you're missing main big things. Like, in other words, you can know, especially if you're just a parent and you're not a professional educator, you know, you might get overwhelmed and intimidated and be worried, oh, gee, the stuff that I'm passing along and having them read I think is right, but are we focusing on stuff that's not important, or even the stuff that I'm passing on, do I understand why it's a big deal? And especially if you're a fan of Austrian economics, some of that stuff gets pretty intense pretty quickly. You know, you start going into what's praxeology and a priori, and, you know, that's difficult stuff. And fractional reserve banking and international trade, all these things. So I'm saying not only is just regular economics a little bit intimidating, but Austrian economics too, because it brings in all the philosophy and stuff. So this teacher's manual I wrote with primarily the homeschooling parent in mind, though obviously even if you're a professional high school teacher who is thinking about using my book as a text, obviously this manual's good for that too. So anyway, Lewis, to answer your question, because we just had that manual come out, and I think it's been a full year since I've taught a principal's session, we might do that one next. In the past, I've had concurrent Mises Academy classes going, you know, meaning like some of them would overlap by 3 or 4 weeks. I'm trying to get away from that because I just can't. It's not fair to the students in the classes because I end up not being able to really hang out the forums much and answer their questions because I'm spread so thin. So I do want to, you know, Danny and I are talking about, in other words, I want to do a brand new course, but I'm not sure what to do with that. Maybe something like, I don't know, competing currencies or something. Because it's a trade-off. It's got to be something that I'm interested in so that I can get fired up and want to devote a bunch of time to developing the lectures. But on the other hand, it's got to be something that other people are interested in. And it seems like, at least with my classes, the ones that get the most attendance are the ones about either the Fed or the business cycle. And so I think something on like competing currencies or something like that might be good. Do you have any, Lewis or anybody else who's joined in, do you have any thing you'd be wishing for? Lewis says, last year I took the 3 courses on Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. Yeah, well, that was, I mean, that's always a possibility, too, that I could just go through some other classic works. Unfortunately, I went through, oh, well, thanks. He says they were great. I guess I could do something like that with Human Action. That might make sense. Maybe we wouldn't go through necessarily every page, but that's actually, are there any other, what other classic books are there that people would want to go through? Because unfortunately, I think my comparative advantage or something is in Bombavrick stuff, but even I am not sure the world is ready for a Mises Academy class going through his capital and interest. That's, I think, unfortunately, the demand. We might need to have a universe of maybe 16 planet Earths so that the people who would be willing to go into that would be enough to make it worth my time. Let me send a quick thing to Danny about that. Well, before I forget. Meanwhile, if you have other questions, Lewis, I think you're one of the few people, anyone else who's signed in, just go ahead and post them. Lewis says capital and interest would be interesting. Well, you know what I think I would probably do though, Lewis, before I would do that is I think, and I have long been wanting to write like a pamphlet called Bombavrick Made Bearable or something, you know, something cute like that where I just go through and explain his basic view and it's sort of like a, I guess, a study guide to Bombavrick's classic work. Not necessarily the way I do the other study guides where I go through each chapter because he does a lot of like blowing up people that it's not necessarily worthwhile summarizing that part of the book, but I have thought that it would be worthwhile to do that. Or maybe something on value theory, like maybe going through Bombavrick's book on economic value, because we hit that, you know, noticing this class on the theory of money and credit in the beginning, you know, where Mises just very quickly starts talking about objective exchange value and that stuff, and I realized it's, even I am not totally comfortable in that area, and I'm sure, well, I know the average fan of Austrian economics isn't comfortable because I don't even think many of the faculty are. Like, I think just the people who really study the history of economic thought might be aware of that stuff, but it's not like, how can I put it? It's not like to be a modern practitioner of Austrian economics, you need to know the foundations of value theory the way that Bombavrick and Mises would have understood it. Because again, it's nowadays we take it for granted so much that it's not, we don't even bother dealing with it because nobody's going to object. So it's not worth our time on that stuff. So it's, I think most people just know it. Like they could explain barter pricing the way Rothbard spells it out in his Man, Economy, and State, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. It's actually a very efficient way to do it. But I'm just saying there, he doesn't deal with a lot of the intricate pitfalls or little things you got to watch out for about you know, the difference between exchange value and use value. That how you know, it can, you know, the prisoners in the POW camp, even if you're a non-smoker, you say, what's the margin utility of a pack of cigarettes? Well, once the cigarettes are the medium of exchange and other people want them, and you know, then all of a sudden that changes it. So it's kind of a complex thing. And then, but still, when you want to explain, well, where do they get their objective exchange value from? Well, it's because there are a lot of smokers, and so it all, you know, feeds in the. So it's a complex thing that feeds on itself, and it's you miss some of that when you just start and say, okay, everyone starts with their subjective ordinal preference rankings, and then from that we can explain barter prices. So it's not that anything in that explanation is wrong. It's, well, really what it is, now that I'm just walking you through it, it's somewhat related to the stuff Mises is doing with money, trying to explain, you know, why is it that you would value something that's intrinsically useless for you as well, because it has objective exchange value. It's a similar type of thing there that, or, you know, even if you, like, if you were a farmer and the stuff you're growing, you know, you might grow tobacco because now there's a market for it. And so it's not even that you value it as a medium of exchange, it's you value it for its exchange value. And so that's, it's sort of somewhat analogous. Like, it's a production good, but the idea is you're trading with nature, intending to trade the tobacco away. So maybe in that sense, it is kind of like it's a medium of exchange, if you want to look at it metaphorically. But the point is, it's, there's a lot of really subtle stuff like that that you wouldn't get just from reading Man, Economy, and State, or even Human Action, because they're focusing on other stuff, and it's, but that stuff is in Bombaver's, I think it's called Principles of Economic Value or something like that. So yeah, that might be one too. But again, I don't know. I think there's probably 30 people that would love that class, but I don't know if there's 80 that would like it enough to sign up for it. And if you don't get up into those, that range, it makes it less enticing for me to develop a whole class around it. Other questions? Okay, Lewis says, last week I was wondering, is there a chance that at some point down the road we get accreditation so we can transfer our academy credits when we're doing a graduate course at university? I've got a degree in economics, and that would be great for my academic prospects. Good question. We get that one a lot. So yes, the quick answer is yes, there is a chance that at some point down the road you get accreditation. I think for sure what we're working on literally like right now, I mean, not me, but Danny Sanchez and the people physically at the Institute, is to make it a little bit more, I don't know what word I want, systematic. And structured so that so every academy class, like, they have characteristics on it, and so we can make the classes comparable, so we can understand, you know, oh gee, this, when Bob taught this class in the theory of money and credit, how would that relate to some, you know, Tom DiLorenzo's course on war or whatever. And because you're right, we do want to, we want to be able to produce like an official transcript for somebody, so that if somebody does take a bunch of our classes and gets good grades in them and things like that, that we can give them something official that they can then give to somebody else. And so for us to do that, and that's partly, in case people are wondering, that's partly why I'm kind of anal about the quizzes being taken on time, and I don't give extensions, and I don't let you see right away what the right answers were on the multiple choice and that kind of stuff, because I know we're trying to move this whole thing to be a little bit more official, for lack of a better term. And at some point, if we've got hundreds of people going through each class and it's affecting their future educational decisions, and we have to convince third parties that if someone has a B+ in my class, it means something, well, there has to be, you know, procedures in place to ensure that it's not really simple to cheat on the quizzes. And you can't just quickly, you know, it's not like the first person who takes the quiz then sees what all the right answers were and then posts it on his blog and then goes and checks that, and now from that point on, everyone gets 100% on that quiz. You know, that's the kind of thing I want to make sure doesn't happen. So we are doing that kind of stuff. But now, to say accreditation, if you mean like officially, That's a hard thing to do, because you have to convince a bunch of, you know, government I don't even know what the relevant boards are, but that's, the government gets involved, because, you know, they're in charge of educational content, blah blah blah. So I think, official accreditation where you literally could transfer credits from the Mises University, or sorry, Mises Academy, to your school somewhere and then opt out of principals because you took my class. I think that is a long way away, but I think there's more intermediate things that are close where, you know, for sure, professors who like the Mises Institute and teach at various places, you know, I know already the fact that you might have done well and taken a bunch of Mises Academy classes, that might make you stand out to those professors more than somebody else. And so, you know, what does that do for you? I mean, it could be something as little as if you want to do an independent study instead of having to take a regular class where you sit in a classroom and take notes and then go take a quiz and take an exam and write a bunch of essays that are real simple. You instead want to take the semester and work on a paper. You know, so like when I taught at Hillsdale, there were options to do things like that. But you didn't, it had to be the right kind of student. And so I'm just saying if a student came up that you didn't really know, but who showed you, oh no, look, I went to the Mises Academy and I took all these classes and look at my grades, you know, they might say, oh, okay, well then go ahead. Or, you know, there's various things. So I'm not really giving you a very specific answer, Lewis, but that's, they are working on that, and if you had specific ideas, you could email, I think Danny Sanchez is kind of in charge of the academy. So he would be the person to say that to. Okay, Jan Masick says, something becomes money when just about everybody uses it for indirect exchange. How much is just about everybody? Isn't it a bit arbitrary? Yes, it is. It is arbitrary. And I think, I don't know if he says it in Theory of Money and Credit, but I'm pretty sure he says it in Human Action, that Mises says something like, when it comes to the theorems involving money, the admittedly there's a hazy line between when is something commonly accepted and when is it not. And he said, but there's a quite sharp line between when is something a medium of exchange and when is it not. So his point is, if you're trying to say, hey, in this transaction, was that thing that was exchanged, was it a medium of exchange or was it not? Mises is saying that's crystal clear. If the person receiving it intends to trade it away again for something else, then it's a medium of exchange. If the person intends to use it personally, then it's not a medium of exchange. I mean, there's no ambiguity there. You as the outsider won't know, but the point is, you know, in the person's mind, it's one thing or the other. I guess, I mean, I suppose you could come up with a situation where you're selling something for tobacco and thinking, I'll probably smoke it, but unless prices go way up, in which case I'll sell it. I guess, you know, you can have cases like that where you're not sure what you're going to use it for. But anyway, that's what he says. But then he said, okay, so now we, you know, it's crystal clear what a medium of exchange is, but now is that medium of exchange money? And then he admits that's not as obvious, because what is money? Just a medium of exchange that's commonly accepted, and where's the boundary line between something that's widely accepted but not commonly, and you know, that's arbitrary. So yes, you're right, Jan. There's no fine line. Let me, and by all means, guys, post more questions, but since there's only a couple of you logged in, I think I have to stall for time here. There was something that was interesting. I didn't dwell on it in the lecture just because of time constraints. I think I said something in the study guide about it, though. But when Mises was talking about different types of monies, he said something that I don't see how it's right. He said that, you know, if one country uses gold and the other country uses silver, that they really, that it wouldn't be right to say that there's one money for one group of people and a different money for the other group. And he says he was arguing gold and silver are money for both groups. And that just didn't seem right to me. He was stressing the interconnectedness of the market and how the merchants who deal with foreign exchange, or, you know, say foreign trade and use the foreign exchange market, you know, they need to kind of be aware of the exchange ratio between gold and silver and what the prices quoted in silver are in the other place, because they need to know, you know, does it make sense for me to import these inputs as opposed to getting them domestically? And for that kind of knowledge, you need to stay abreast of the silver prices quoted in the other country, even if in your country they use gold. Okay, so, but it just, that seemed weird to me, because that would, I think if you push that line of reasoning, that would mean every medium of exchange was money for everybody on planet Earth. And that clearly can't be right. And so once you acknowledge that there can be a medium of exchange for some people but not for other people, then I don't see why, you know, you wouldn't say, okay, so then there can be money for one group and not for another by the same token. So there's that issue too, Jan, that when we say just about everybody, or if we say it's commonly accepted, we necessarily have to mean for just a particular group, because there's no single commodity right now that is accepted by just about everybody on planet Earth. So, and that, you know, if that's what you're going to use, then you would have to say nothing is money, and that's clearly crazy. So, anyway, there's more nuances with that. Okay, Lewis says, he's asking me about something that I was trying to avoid. About the differences between currency policy and monetary policy, would you say the latter is a wider concept than the former? Or is it just focused on a different target than in Mises' days? Well, since this is the whole point of office hours, let me pull that up. I don't know, Jim, because I need to – I forget what the translator was saying the difference was. Do I have it up here? No, I don't. Hang on a second. Okay, so that would be, what chapter is that in? Maybe just search for it. Okay, what is it, chapter 7? Okay, and I'm zooming in now. Have you guys had this issue? I don't know what it is. I switched to a MacBook, and I don't know if it's because of that or just because of some of these PDFs, but the default software, the preview mechanism that it uses that I scroll through PDFs, it's really hard for me to read the theory of money and credit. Like, it scrolls really slowly and it blows up the pages. Like, I have to keep swinging the thing from the left to the right to be able to see the next page. Okay, let me see here. I'm almost there, if you'll bear with me. Inflationism. Is this it? No, 221. Sorry. Hey, what is this? One kind of money. What I'm doing, I'm sorry for this delay, I'm trying to find the exact page where the translator explains how he was translating currency policy versus monetary policy. Okay, so it's the beginning of chapter 7. So, in terms of the English translation here that we're reading, the chapter 7 is named Monetary Policy. Section 1 is called Monetary Policy Defined. But then in the text, it has Mises talking over and over again about currency policy. So it's a little bit weird. And then, but there's a footnote 1 to Monetary Policy Defined, and so let's read that. And he says, the author uses the term Geldwertpolitik, and I'm of course butchering that, in the technical sense defined in the above section. I have reserved the term monetary policy for this special meaning. Currency policy is the term I have used to translate Geldwertpolitik. All right, so the problem here is even if we went back to the previous section and figured out what that other G word meant that he has reserved the term monetary policy for, it's still not clear we'd be able to contract it with currency policy because he doesn't say here in this footnote how those two terms differ. And let me see if we can search for that. Maybe, you know, in the other one he did. And see, the thing is, when I search for that term, it's only showing me the only hit is the one in footnote 1. So I don't know if it's just because the search engine's not recognizing the weird German letters. But so the problem okay. So, Jan, are you're saying you're just translating the actual, like the you know, transliterating, you're saying that those are those terms mean. So what is the other one? What is the one that he has for currency policy? What does that mean? Literally. Currency policy. Okay. All right, hang on one more time. Let me just. Okay, so just, sorry for those of you who are listening to this and not seeing the chat box. What's happening is Jan told me that that it means. That literally that term means monetary value policy, and that the W word, I'm not going to butcher, literally translated as currency policy. So it sounds like we're not going to get too much. It's not like there's hidden meaning if we could know what the original German words meant. It sounds like it's basically the one term is monetary the money value policy, and there's currency policy. But see, the thing that is so weird is that on this very page 216, so here's the problem, Jan, and what I'm thinking, and the reason, so for sure the reason I didn't bother with this distinction, and I even think Mises isn't, what I think may be happening is that this editor is, and translator is, focusing on a distinction that Mises didn't think was that important. Because, you know, by the translator's own admission, Mises in the German must have called the beginning of chapter 7, you know, the first two things he must have used the German equivalent of monetary policy. And then in the text, in that section, he must have used the German equivalent of currency policy. So it doesn't make any sense that Mises is going to title something monetary policy defined and then clearly define currency policy unless, you know, Mises thought those two things were the same. So in other words, it's not like in that section, Mises then later goes on to talk about monetary policy, you know, as opposed to currency policy. He just keeps over and over calling it currency policy. So I I don't know what to tell you, except it looks like for me, Mises didn't think it was a big deal. So when you say, Jan, where did you put that in? Where the heck was that? What was your question? Oh, so when you say, is it possible that monetary policy is just a wider concept than currency policy? I don't know, because it's not clear that for Mises there's any distinction. Oh, yeah, it was Lewis who asked this question, right? So, I wish I could be of more help, but this is why, this is sort of like a special features on your DVD where they're talking to the director and you see how they meet certain. This is why I didn't really stress that in the study guide, because I'm not sure what the distinction is for the reasons we've talked about. And again, because it looks like Mises, you can get what I'm saying, everybody, that's crazy. Why would Mises say, title something monetary policy defined, and then in the text just keep talking over and over about currency policy, never mention monetary policy? That doesn't make any sense unless for Mises the two are the same thing. And for sure nowadays, at least in the English-speaking world, nobody talks about currency policy. I can't recall the last time I've heard that. So I guess you're right, Lewis, if you had to guess. To me, monetary policy sounds like a broader concept than currency policy. Currency policy makes it sound like you're focused, on the pieces of paper, whereas monetary policy sounds like you're focusing more on, the dollar as opposed to the actual pieces of paper. But I don't think that's the way Mises is using those terms, because Mises explicitly says currency policy refers to the objective exchange, influencing the objective exchange value of money. So when Mises is using what has been translated as currency policy, he's not narrowly focusing just on paper notes. And he's certainly not narrowly focusing on fiat paper notes, because in his mind, he wasn't even sure if fiat money existed at that point. Okay, so I should probably stop spending so much time when my answer is basically, I don't know. Okay, Jan says, DeSoto says that all stages of production have the same interest rate. If not, people would shift into stages where the interest rate is higher. Why higher? I would expect lower, because lower interest means lower costs for them, cheaper loans, doesn't it? Well, let me, what he means is, for the Austrian approach to these things, you look at the different stages, and there's the originary interest rate that's implicit in the prices of the factors of production, and then what you can sell the finished good for down the road. And, well, then by finished good, I just mean from your perspective. So you could be a miller who gets wheat and turns it into flour. And so from your point of view, the flour is the finished good that you sell to your customers. So your customer could be another big company. I'm not talking just about the bread that goes to the final consumer in the grocery store. So what DeSoto means is, you're a capitalist and you're trying to figure out, where do I put my money? I should be more specific. You're trying to say, where do I put my capital, my financial capital? And you say, oh, I could invest it in wheat, and then you know, so buying the wheat and then selling and then hiring the services of the miller, and then they turn it into flour, and then I sell the flour 1 year later for a higher price. And then what's the implicit rate of return on my invested financial capital? And that's one number. Or I could get into this industry closer to the final sale, when I could buy the loaves of bread that are already nicely packaged and everything, and then just hire the services of the shipping company, you know, the trucks, to take it to the grocery store, and then I sell it to the grocer there for a higher price than what I paid. You know, and what's the rate of return there? And so wherever the rate of return is higher, that's where I might, you know, that's where I would go into. Or if you want to get more realistic and realize people have different skills and areas of competence, still, if there is one sector where the rate of return is 8% and there's another sector where it's 6, you would expect on the margin people to be shuffling around so that more people would jump into where there's an 8% return. Jan says, okay, so basically interest rate is like profit here. It's what we would call accounting profit. And that's the thing is, so the Austrians, not just the Austrians, but in general, economists take what the layperson refers to as profit, and they say, well, no, that's accounting profit. And then they pull out the interest return. And then they say what's left is pure profit. So, it gets a little bit mixed up because now you can say, well, how could the interest rate be higher than, isn't it that all stages always have the same pure interest rate, and the one stage has a higher profit than the other one? And different Austrians probably would answer that question differently. But for sure, what DeSoto was talking about is that, yes, when you take money and you buy factors of production and then produce the thing that's next in line and sell it, what is the markup? What is the rate of return on your invested financial capital? And that has to be, or there's a tendency for that to be the same in every stage, because if it weren't, then people would flock to the stage that has a higher implicit rate of return. And then by doing that, it goes away. Right, because if more people are jumping into that stage, more people are trying to buy the factors of production that are specific to that stage, so that pushes up their price. And then whatever it is that the output is from that stage, there's more of it now, so more people are jumping in, and so that pushes down the price. So the gap between the factors of production and the output good in terms of prices, that gap shrinks because you're pushing up the factor prices, you're pushing down the final good price. And so the rate of return gets knocked down, and then the sectors where people are fleeing, the opposite happens, so the rates of return there go up, and that is going to keep happening until you have a uniform rate of return for any stage you happen to get into. Okay, Jan says, which takes me into another question. Standard ABCT, Austrian Business Cycle Theory, deals with one interest rate only, but in reality there are many. How does it change the ABCT, and who wrote about it so I can dive into more detail? Did you, with a smiley face? I don't know if you're just buttering me up, Jan, but I mean, I literally did, for a recent Liberty Fund conference, write a paper on Austrian business cycle theory and multiple interest rates. So yes, yeah. So if you want to say who's the world's expert on the fact that there are multiple interest rates and how do we apply that to Austrian business cycle theory, then this guy. Okay, let me see. Where would it? I put it on my blog. I'm Googling it right now, Jan, to give you the link. Let's see, so I'll just try. Robert Murphy, multiple interest rate. Let's see if that comes up. Yeah. Okay, so I'll give you the HTML link, so I'm not posting a PDF link. So I, for people who are listening online or people who are listening after the fact, if you, it's at my blog. If you, the cutesy title I gave to the post was "My Heretical and Pathbreaking Work on Austrian Interest Theory." So if you just Google Robert Murphy multiple interest rate, and then you see the search results, just find the one that's near the top. Because what you want is the thing at my blog, which is consultingbyrpm.com. And the name of the post is "My Heretical and Pathbreaking Work on Austrian Interest Theory." And then in there, I've got two links. So one link's to my dissertation, which gets into this stuff. And the other one I'm calling a long paper I wrote for a recent Liberty Fund conference. All right, so Jan, if you're interested in the multiple interest rate deal, you definitely want to read that B. So let me post the link here in the chat box. Okay, so again, if you go to that link, there are the links to two PDFs. It, let me know, Jan, if that doesn't work, because I think I switched my blog host over since that was posted. So I'm nervous that maybe the PDFs that I was hosting at the old blog, that maybe they didn't get moved over, the links don't work. So let me know if that link doesn't work. Okay, great. Apparently it works. Okay, we got about 10 minutes left. I think I've answered all your guys' outstanding questions, so keep posting. I'm just scrolling back here. I don't think there's anything pending. So I'll give you 10 seconds to do one, and if not, I'm going to start talking about that paper, just to warn you. All right, so while the few people who are logged in live here are thinking, let me just explain a little bit about what's in that paper. So what I realize this camera angle is off. What happened there, the context for that paper is it was a Liberty Fund conference hosted by Walter Block on Austrian business cycle theory. So, you know, he invited various people, and some of us were, our job was to write a paper for the conference, and then other people there were just supposed to, you know, come and read the papers and comment on them. So my task was to deal with, okay, what do we do with the fact that in the real world, there are multiple interest rates, not just the interest rate. You know, what does that do for Austrian business cycle theory? So I tackled that, and there's actually a lot of different things involved there. Just for one example is there's a difference, you know, there's, depending on the maturity, there are different interest rates, right? So if they say right now, even just focusing on government bonds, even the same government, you know, United States federal government bonds, and you say, hey, what's the interest rate? What's the yield on those right now? There's not a single number. I have to ask, well, wait a minute, what do you need? For a 1 month, a 3 month, a 6 month, a 1 year? You know, there's a difference between notes, bills, and bonds, that sort of thing. A 30-year? So there's that issue, and if, for those of you who know financial markets, you know that that involves what's called the yield curve. And so what's called a normal yield curve, at least in the modern era with fiat money, it might not have been normal back in the 1800s, but nowadays a normal yield curve has an increasing yield with maturity, so that if you're lending money to the U.S. government for 6 months, you'll get one interest rate. If you're willing to lend your money for longer, you're going to get a higher interest rate, even accounting for the fact, you know, on an annualized basis, in other words. So I'm not just saying, oh, you get more total interest because the money's rolling over longer. I'm saying even adjusting for, you know, the same unit of time, the rate of return per year or whatever is higher typically in a longer loan. But however, that's not always the case. You can get what's called an inverted yield curve, where short-term yields are higher than long-term yields, which is kind of strikes people as weird. And then the other thing that's interesting is an inverted yield curve seems to be associated with an oncoming recession. So in particular, like since the 1950s, that if you define precisely what do you mean by inverted yield curve, like does it have to be, you know, what's going to count as that and how long is it going to persist? Like if it just happens for 13 minutes one day on the exchange, does that count? And it's, well, no, we mean like if it stays inverted for 3 weeks or whatever. So if you define it a certain way, there is a plausible way to define those terms by what do I mean by an inverted yield curve, what's going to count, such that from the 1950s onward, every time the yield curve inverts, there has been a recession shortly following. And again, you have to specify what do I mean by shortly. And every time there has been a recession, you can find the yield curve inverting shortly beforehand. And again, you have to be careful. What do I mean by recession? Because there's one borderline case where there was an economic slowdown, but technically it didn't count as a recession, that kind of stuff. But the point is, it's uncanny at its apparent ability to signal that there is a recession coming. And so then economists try to come up with theoretical explanations for why should this happen. And it's ironic that the mainstream approach based on CAPM and a consumption version of that, it's all very nice and theoretically elegant, but it gives the exact wrong answer. I hesitate to say that too loudly because you would think, you know, how could they have been that wrong? But I've read, you know, a few of the papers in that vein, and it sure looks like they're saying, you know, they build up the logic of their position and say, well, this is what we would expect to see, da 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 da. And you just step back and say, but wait a minute, that would mean an inverted yield curve should show that a recession is about to end, not that a recession is about to start. It doesn't make any sense. So anyway, what's interesting is I think Austrian business cycle theory gives a completely straightforward explanation for why you would expect that when the yield curve inverts, a recession is going to follow. Because if you think about it, in the Austrian view, what causes the boom-bust cycle? Well, when times are so-called good, when you're in the midst of a boom, it's because the banks are flooding the market with fiduciary media, right? So that pushes down interest rates. But if you think about it, if you don't just focus on the interest rate, but instead you realize there are multiple interest rates, which ones are going to be more malleable with respect to banking policy? So in other words, when the banks flood the credit markets with fiduciary media, and we say, oh, that pushes down interest rates, it probably is going to push down the 3-month interest rate more than it pushes down the 30-year interest rate. And so during the boom phase, I think it makes sense to realize that the banks flooding the credit markets will push down the short end of the yield curve more than they'll push down the long end. And so what would that do? That would mean during a boom period, the yield curve would look upward sloping. The short rates would be lower than long rates, which is what people refer to as normal nowadays. And they think of as, you know, during normal times of prosperity, when the Austrians would actually be saying, no, we're in the middle of an unsustainable boom. And then what happens? What causes the boom to switch to a bust? Well, the banks tighten. And so that makes interest rates go up. But again, it doesn't make all interest rates go up uniformly across the board. You would expect short rates to rise more quickly than long rates because it was short rates that were being pushed down artificially the most. So when the banks all stop inflating, short rates zoom up. Long rates might go up a little bit. But the other thing is, they actually might not, because another element to all this is, yeah, if there's more fiduciary media, there's more credit, and therefore to get the credit market to clear, to, you know, balance quantity of demanded and supplied in terms of borrowing, yeah, the banks flooding the market with more credit would push down interest rates. But if people start expecting prices to rise because now there's more money, then they might insist on a higher interest rate. And so in the long term, it's not as obvious that if the banks are creating more money, that that's going to push down long-term interest rates. You actually might see the opposite, that long-term interest rate rise. So the point is that kind of exacerbates this seesaw effect, that when the banks now tighten up and they stop inflating, you could even expect long rates to go down, because now that might reduce people's expectations of long-term price inflation. And so you can see how those various forces, when you add them all up, it might mean that when the banks tighten, short rates zoom up higher than long rates, because short rates are going up and long rates either aren't going up or aren't going up as much, or they might even go down because of those interactions of price inflation expectations. So it seems like if you were going to, you know, even if you didn't know about this phenomenon, about the yield, inverted yield curve, just standard Austrian business cycle theory might lead you to expect that, oh yeah, probably during the boom period, short rates are lower than long rates, and then when the banks tighten, short rates zoom up at least temporarily higher than long rates. And then for the Austrians, that's, you know, when that, those monetary disturbances happen, the bust is on the way. And so, you know, you'd have to tell a story about the timing and everything, but prima facie, that seems perfectly consistent with the Austrian story, whereas with the mainstream explanation, like I said, if anything, it's the exact opposite of what it's supposed to be. It's not merely that it's, I'm not saying it's implausible. I'm saying what they go through, the logic of their arguments, kind of, you know, it's a very hyper-rational approach that they give. You know, in other words, they rely on people being long-term consumption smoothing agents and looking at their income from now until the end of time, and then based on their expectations of a disturbance coming down the road, and, oh, there's going to be a recession in 2 years, and so my income at that time will be lower, and so now I rationally take that into account, so I adjust my decisions, da-da-da-da-da, and what does that do to interest rates? And so it's like, you know, this hyper-rational expectations approach where the market, the bond market forecasts what everybody kind of already knows. And so it tells us a recession is coming because we all know a recession is coming, which, yeah, I'm putting it in the worst possible light, but the point is that's kind of what they're saying. And my point is I'm not saying that objection or that explanation is wrong because of its implausibility. I'm not just saying, oh, yeah, but people don't really know that a recession's coming or they're not robots, blah, blah. No, I'm just saying the logic of their explanation, if you follow it through, implies that when people think a recession is imminent, you should have an upward sloping yield curve. And then when they think, if you're in the middle of a recession, if now they think that the recovery is imminent, then that should lead to an inverted yield curve according to the logic of that hyper-rational story. But yet, again, that is the exact opposite of the brute empirical facts that we're trying to explain. So that's one of the things I cover in that paper. Okay, so we're out of time, and it looks like that was all the pending questions. Yeah, so Jan says, I called you on the shift show this week, but they didn't let me talk to you. Yeah, so for those who don't know, I was on, and here, I'll go ahead and post, I have the link to it. Tom Woods had, when Tom Woods was the guest host, as he often is, for the Peter Schiff show, and then he had me on. It's kind of neat. It's like when I was younger, so there's the YouTube link. Well, right. To go to Peter Schiff's website, but there's a YouTube that has art, and I don't know if that's a violation of IP or whatever, so I'm neither endorsing nor condemning. I'm just saying there it is if you want to go break the law. But on Rush Limbaugh would frequently have Walter Williams be his host, and then typically when Walter Williams was the host, he would have Thomas Sowell come on for like a quick, you know, two commercial break thing. And so that, in my daydreams and narcissistic fantasies, I like to imagine that Peter Schiff is the analog of Rush Limbaugh and Tom is the analog of Walter Williams, who's the real fun guy that people can listen to for 3 hours. And then I'm kind of the nerdy guy that he brings in that, like, people say, oh, yeah, they're very similar, but they'd rather listen to Tom for 3 hours than me. Just like Walter Williams could carry a radio show. But, Thomas Sowell really couldn't. Okay. So I will, so thanks for tuning in, guys, and this stuff is going to get really good next week. I'm actually now going to log off and read the stuff that you're assigned for next week because I just want to do what I can, that's how much of a geek we are sometimes.